I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the beautiful Port Neuf Valley in the heart of the Rockies, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Well, today our guest is Robert Mayer from the Magical Valley Astronomical Society. We're looking up today, way up. Let's talk about stargazing in Idaho. Peter, it's season two.
It is season two. We made it through the first year.
It's a new year. It's 2020. I'm excited about it.
Right.
We've got all sorts of new things to talk about this year. And last season was a lot of fun. This season...
it's going to be more fun.
Twice as fun.
Season two fun.
Hey, I understand you have a bit of nature news.
I've got some nature news. A team of researchers from the United States, United Kingdom, Ireland, Australia, and Switzerland, including mathematicians, physicists, chemists, and material experts, have found that fewer coffee beans ground more coarsely will make cheaper, more consistent, and just as strong espresso.
Really? So
yes.
Wait, so we've been cutting it too thinly.
And what's happening is that they found out when they grind those beans to superfine particles, they used to think that creates more surface area.
Right.
More surface area, more flavor.
That makes sense to me.
But what was happening is this fine ground coffee was getting plugged up into the filter bed. And so you were getting inconsistent brews. You know, they're pushing the water through
right.
the filter bed at a pressures, and it wasn't consistently moving through that filter bed. So it was skipping parts of the coffee grounds. And then when you tried to clean the filter bed out, it would have some leftover, quote, contaminants.
Oh, geez.
The coarser, larger grind made a more consistent cup of espresso.
So does that affect the amount of caffeine that's in that espresso,
no.
I wonder?
No. The only thing, there's two things that it really truly affects. It affects the bottom line of the coffee industry.
Sure.
In the United States alone, if all these companies and businesses start grinding their beans coarser, they're going to save over $1 billion a year on coffee.
Huh.
And then when you look at the conservation end of it with the coffee plantations, there's lots of concern about sun-grown coffee. That's where they come into areas and basically strip the land and just plant these massive coffee plantations, not very good in the environment. If we start reducing our coffee intake, saving money and saving the need to strip our habitats, we're talking about a win-win situation here.
Well, so we could get better coffee by using less of it, by grinding it more coarsely.
Yes.
All right. There's our first tip of the season for everybody that likes coffee.
Grind it coarse.
Grind it coarser. Well, very good. If that sounded trivial, here's trivia for this year, our first of the year. What is the name of the comet that is visible right now with binoculars? It'll be visible for the first half of 2020. What's the name of that comet? Well, conveniently, we have a guest that's going to be able to tell us the answer for that right after this break.
Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org. Or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
All right, we're back from the break. I want to welcome Robert Mayer. He's the president of the Magic Valley Astronomical Society. First off, thank you for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, Robert, you watch the night sky very closely, being president of the Astronomical Society there in Magic Valley. How did you start getting into looking at the night sky, and tell us about that?
Actually, it's a story that I won't take 50 years to tell it, but it goes back 50, 60 years. My grandfather was walking past a pawn shop in Ontario, I believe it was in Ontario or Nisa, Oregon, and found a cheap little scope for $50, bought that, and didn't know how to use it. My mother said you couldn't see anything out of it, and then when I turned 14, he gave it to me. I tried it out. You still couldn't use anything to it, and then about 20 years later, went up to City of Rock Star Party, where the Magic Valley Astronomical Society was functioning, and tried to see if I could get something with it. And up there, you can, and it just kind of snowballed from there. I've gone from that little scope to using some of the club's larger scopes, and then the group associates closely with the College of Southern Idaho's Harrit Center and its Centennial Observatory, and it's 2-foot diameter telescope, and we help out on that quite a bit too.
That's wonderful. Where it went. That's wonderful. So it started from an inherited telescope.
Yes.
That's great.
That didn't work as well as you
had
hoped.
That didn't work.
So
you're persistent about it.
Right.
Well, yes. When people get telescopes, they need to understand cheap telescopes have issues, yes. And I tinkered around with it, found a way to make it work, showed something a few years later to my mother, and she went, wow, you really can see things with this. So.
And when you look at it kind of like a telescope's design, you've got the lenses and some mirrors and such. And if a lens or a mirror is dirty or dusty, or if you clean it with something not appropriate for the lens, you kind of mess the whole thing up, don't you?
Yes. The big issue actually is eyepieces. And with your smaller scopes, the eyepieces are cheap, almost borderline. Well, I'll use the word junk. And in this case, that's what my grandfather had. And I went to the great online garage sale and got a better eyepiece, put it in there, and went, wow, this thing does work. So,
yep.
So yeah, that's the big key.
Well, I think a lot of us, especially at an early age, you know, look up to the skies, and somebody might even start teaching us some of the names of the stars and the constellations, and that's maybe a foothold into more serious investigations of the night sky. Was that your experience as well?
On my dad's side of the family, my father was big into science, and he was big into science fiction, and so you combine him tossing science fiction at me and me reading about all those worlds, and I wanted to connect Grandpa's telescope to that. And that's really how it came about. Now, when we go to star parties, that's what the kids want to hear. They want to hear these stories of the legends behind the constellations. That's what really interests them about the worlds the Greeks created.
And the great part about that is it's just not an interest in the star or the constellation. You can bring that full circle back into becoming an astronomer, but it's the exciting stories about the legends of the constellations. And you know, Orion and Orion's belt is one that's super easy to kind of see. But when you start talking about the legend of Orion, you know, that's where you bring these kids into the whole idea of stargazing.
Yes, definitely.
Idaho is a special place for many, many reasons, and we've tried to get to the heart of that in our first season of shows, and we'll keep on doing that. But here, one of the reasons to talk about stargazing in Idaho in particular is we really have something special to look at. Could you tell us about why Idaho is particularly well positioned for folks to enjoy the night sky?
Idaho has a relative lack of light, what's called light pollution. That is, we really only have really one major urban area in Boise, and there are, you know, significant distance between Twin Falls and Boise, and then we have the great central Idaho area and all great wilderness, and to the point that we can see things in the sky because we don't suffer from city lights that other places do. You have a person come from back east, particularly east of the Mississippi, and look up in our Idaho sky, and it could be a bad night in Pocatello or a bad night in Twin Falls, and they're going, what is that? Because, you know, I lived in Rupert for a few years, and I could make out the Milky Way. And people back east go, what's the Milky Way? We have some great places that do that. In fact, Idaho has received some notice in that there's the Central Idaho Dark Sky Preserve. It's an extensive set of acreage where people know when they go up there, they're going to see really unpolluted skies. And it's not a government designation. It's just sort of a stamp from a group that says this area has worked hard to make sure you can see the best in the night sky. And we have a colleague there named Tim Frazier who has worked really hard with others, several others, working with people in Stanley and Haley and so on to really make sure that the communities are cooperating and coming up with the proper lighting and things like that so that people aren't blotted out. And we got it just in time because you see pictures of the Sawtooth Range from Lower Stanley at night. You can see the lights of Boise starting to creep over. But fortunately, where I live in the Magic Valley and Wood River Valley, we have up there, Craters of the Moon is now been received dark sky designation. City of Rocks and Hagerman Fossil Beds National Monument are two other places that should sometime in the future with some work get that kind of designation too.
So when you look at some of the more famous observatories, they're really up on top of mountains and higher elevations. Do we have in Idaho that same advantage when you look at the Dark Sky Preserve? We're not sitting at sea level. So are we moving through some of the atmospheric interferences as well?
Atmospheric interferences are less of an issue. We've talked about going up and doing star parties, say, up at the top of Mount Harrison. And somebody pointed out that at above 7,500 feet, the atmospheric pressure tends to lessen, and that actually affects your eyesight. Your eyesight above 7,500 feet because of the less atmospheric pressure is actually worse. So, no, it's more the fact that we're out in rural spaces and we have less urban development in Idaho. That's pretty much the reason why.
That's combined with generally more clear nights, I would imagine, as well.
I can tell you this much. From the data I've seen from Royal Astronomical Society of Canada, they figured out that in winter, 50% of the time, Idaho's skies will be clear. In spring and summer, it's about 70% of the time. So I don't know how that compares to other places. To me, that's probably the best way to word it. That's the way to give you an idea of what we're facing. 70% of the time, we're going to get some great stuff in the summer.
Now, not too long ago, we had the full eclipse travel through the center part of our state. One of the preferred locations to observe it was Idaho, largely because the percent chance that it would be a clear sky, as it was very high in our region.
So as you're going out stargazing, what's one of your favorite places to go where you do get the best views on a regular basis?
Well, we have two places. We make it a point to go every summer, and we invite the public to show up. In particular, Castle Rock State Park, City of Rocks, is a place we go every summer. We've also been putting in time at the Oregon Trail Overlook at the Hagerman Fossil Beds National Monument. We went there skeptically, but they talked us in, that the staff there said, you need to come on up there. And we're rather surprised at what you can see up there. It's quite nice. I can tell you one of my impressions of looking out at Castle Rock State Park is you actually get tired of looking at the Milky Way and how bright it is. You know, there's you just go, get out of the way, please.
Yeah, there's so much more to watch, to look at.
Yes, yeah. And those are some of the places. Those are for the public star parties. For private, when we just want to get three or four of us together, we've gone over to Thorn Creek Ridge. I've been trying out Massacre Rocks State Park. I was surprised at how gorgeous Lake Walcott State Park was and how what you could see there. Idaho state parks are almost perfectly aligned for dark sky viewing, in all fairness.
And as you're looking in the night sky, what are you looking for?
The best way to do that is, I have to give a sort of clarification here or a prep work. Most people just go out in the sky and they say, okay, I'm going to see something. You kind of have to, before you go, you kind of have to prep. And so some of the things I will look for is, yes, I'll go see if there's any comets available. I'll go see whether the moon is up. If it's a full moon, I'm probably actually not going to go out. If it's a half moon, I'm going to spend my time looking at the moon. If there's no moon, then I'm going to look for darker objects, such as galaxies, open clusters, nebulae. Small scopes will pick a lot of those up, naked eye and binoculars. There are times when you can pick some of those up, and it will also depend the scope you're bringing. If you're feeling like, well, I'm going to do a major activity, let's bring the big beast up. But, you know, if there's time you say, I just want to get out, bring a little scope or binoculars, you can still be surprised. The club also kind of mocks me in that I'm the double star junkie, and I'm not sure how many people know this, but more than 50% of the stars you see in the sky are at least a binary. And for example, you go up and look at the Big Dipper, and you go one star in from the handle, there's Alcorin Mizar. Now, I don't know if you can see it in Pocatello. I know you can't in Boise. In Twin Falls, you stare at Alcorin Mizar. You can kind of see this little star on top of the bright star, and that's Alcor, the little one, and that means horse and rider. Well, in a telescope, I can split that from two into three, and larger observatories have done computer work and math work and work using chemical analysis and have found out there's actually probably six there. So I love being able to say, can I split, what size of scope do I need to split that star to see what's there? And they provide some fascinating colors, too. Yeah, there's a star in Cygnus, the swan, at its head called Albireo, that we call the Cub Scout star because it's blue and yellow once you split it. And so sometimes we also look at the colors instead of being able to say, ooh, look at this big object. Sometimes subtlety is a wonderful thing to look at.
I've also found it kind of fun, especially with binoculars, to look at the planets and try to pick off moons off of the planets.
Yes, and that's one thing I left out. The other thing is you track out what moons are up around the planets. With Jupiter, a good hunting monoscope, and I have pulled it off in dark sky places with 7x35 binoculars, and modest average binoculars, that is, the moons of Jupiter. Those of you who look in the west right now, the big bright ball is Venus, and that's going to be up for a while. It's a fascinating opportunity. The planet Uranus is hard to pick out with telescopes. It's hard to find. And Uranus is going to be right next to Venus for the next couple of months, and so that's an opportunity to go there. There's just a lot of things, and that's how you keep involved in the hobby as you go, where do you go next? You know, what's up in the sky? What's available? So.
Right, and it seems like there's a never-ending set of storylines that are active at night. Every
yes.
time of the year.
Yes.
I remember one of the ways in was through looking at meteor showers, and that obviously doesn't require more equipment than just patience, maybe, and lying out and waiting for the light show to begin. What are the key times of the year to catch meteor showers that won't disappoint?
Usually there is the Perseids in August, and then you can look up others such as the Lyrids. The Geminids are usually in December. I think the key to remember with meteor showers, their best viewing is after midnight. So it's not just patience, you've got to stay up late. The Perseids are the big beast. The other challenge is, if that's a full moon night, you're kind of doomed. And so it actually varies from year to year in that case. But the Perseids are our great meteor showers. We just missed something called the Quadrantids. That's one I've really never taken the time to take a look at, and that has mixed output. Meteor showers are signs of a comet coming close to our Earth and disturbing, and so it really kind of disturbing the sky above us, if you will. And so it really kind of depends on, well, for lack of a better word, the comet's how it's doing and how it's moving about. So, but usually Perseids. Taurids are one that pops up in the fall as well, if I recall correctly.
Excellent. Say, I'm a beginner. I've got some interest in stargazing. What are some things that you and your club would do to kind of capture my interest and really encourage me to pursue stargazing? You know, in a sense, even with a child, where do you start? Do you start with just, hey, look at the moon, or here's another object in the sky? What are some things that you would show off to a fledgling stargazer?
Well, what we would do is what we do at the City of Rocks is that, first off, we're going to try to plan for a relatively moonless night, and then we're going to start with the planets for you in our telescopes. Then we'll split some double stars, and then we'll start splitting some of the brighter objects. I mean, not the brighter, the more deeper objects. In particular, one that's a favorite for our groups will be what's called M13 in the summer. M13 is a globular cluster in the constellation Hercules. And up at City of Rocks, if you have small binoculars and you go look at the constellation Hercules, you will see this star that, well, I like to tell the youth and the children to look at. I said, does it look like it's a star that needs to lose weight? And he goes, yeah. And then you put a telescope on it, and they go, wow. So, and then usually what happens after that is people start coming around and start asking more questions, and we dig out the laser pointer and start pointing out the constellations to them. And because that's actually after you come and spend time with us, that's what you need to do next, is you just need to sit down and take in the whole sky. Don't worry about the big scope. Don't worry about binoculars just yet. Take in the sky. We had a colleague in our group that we'd all be in a hurry to set up our scopes, and he'd dig out his lounge chair with his constellation map. We said, what are you doing? You're missing out on this opportunity. He says, I'm taking it in. And when you do that, you begin to see what he's talking about. You have to not just get caught up in the intricacies. and the science, but you have to see the beauty. And I think when we learn that few people back east can see the Milky Way, we do slow down quite a bit and go, let's just take it in instead of rushing.
That's a good point. I don't know if it makes you feel small looking at all of that grandeur up there, knowing how far things are away from you and how actually large they really are up close. But it's a real treasure that we have in the night sky, and I think it's an easy thing to take for granted, especially when you live here all the time. It's there. It's always there, and it's present.
For Leif and myself, when we do Nature of Idaho, that's the one thing we want people to realize who live in Idaho is not to take for granted just the amazing things we have around us. And looking at the night sky is something I think a lot of us forget to do. We're too busy looking down.
You got to create a sense of wonder. One of the things that I do remember is we used to have it, your satellite phones are made by the Iridium company, and they used to have it set up that when these satellites would turn their solar panels, it would cause a flash or a flare. And researchers and amateur astronomers figured out when that would be, and they would get brighter than Venus, much brighter than Venus. And what would be fun was fun for us is we'd get the calendar out and figure out when that's going to happen and point that out. I remember working with my colleagues doing a function for 800 Girl Scouts at the Twin Falls County Fairgrounds. We pointed out, and I said, watch, and you watch a dim little thing all of a sudden just get brighter than Venus. And hearing 800 people say, ooh, all at once, you go, yeah.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
And the marvel never goes away, because last night I was walking with my wife a little bit, and I didn't know the International Space Station was overhead. I hadn't checked it. And I looked up in the sky, and I saw Venus, and I went, oh, that's nice. What's that thing? I don't recognize it. And then went, oh. And I have seen the International Space Station so many times, and yet every time I see it, it's like I'm lucky to be able to see it.
It gets your attention, doesn't it? What about Northern Lights? Northern Lights, of course, the sort of shimmering of greens and whites usually on the horizon. Do they come far enough south here to be able to capture them or see them?
Rarely do they. And even then, you have to study what's called solar weather, and you have to keep up to date for that and look out for solar flares or coronal mass ejections, the terms we would use. And when you see that activity, you then know to look. But it has to be fairly strong. Most people in Canada will get them, and then maybe northern New York. I've had some people take pictures up in Coeur d'Alene, and we had a colleague who now focuses his time chasing lightning photography, but he also tries to catch northern lights, and I don't think he's had much luck. So unfortunately, northern lights aren't much. And then you toss in the fact that the sun is just coming out of the solar minimum, that is, its activity is rare. And so those of us with telescopes that have solar filters, we're not even seeing sunspots now. And so with that, the likelihood of other phenomena, you're not going to get northern lights with that.
Sure. So. Okay. Well, we started the show off with a trivia question, and that is, what is the name of the comet that is visible right now with binoculars, and certainly for the first half of 2020? Could you tell us that?
It is the comet Pan-STARRS. Actually, Pan-STARRS is an observatory, and they found several comets, but this is the one we're going to go with. And this is, it will be in the northwestern sky in the constellations Perseus and Cassiopeia. You look in the sky, you'll see a W or an M, depending on when you're up. Right now, we're hoping it's going to be bright enough with binoculars in the next few weeks. We know with small telescopes, it's very likely visible. It's going to be one of the brighter comets we've seen in a long time. There's an outside chance, and I'm really kind of stretching it, that if you go up in the mountains, you might be able to spot it with the naked eye, but it would just be a fuzzy, fat star. But with telescopes, it will be absolutely fascinating to watch.
We want to thank Robert Mayer from the Magic Valley Astronomical Society for joining us today. To learn more about the society, please go to the Magic Valley Astronomical Society Facebook page.
The Nature of Idaho is produced at KISU FM Studios at Idaho State University in Pocatello. Technical assistance and production by Jamin Anderson and Caitlin Hart. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of this and all past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at kisu.org. Find The Nature of Idaho weekly podcast on iTunes or Google Play Music. For more information, click on the Idaho logo at kisu.org or send email to noid@isu.edu.